Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Alana Levine.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Little known fact about my guest today, she grew up in a family that is theater royalty, but she has made an incredible, indelible mark of her own. Welcome Jenny Gersten to the podcast.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey everyone, my guest today is artistic director and producer on Broadway, Jenny Gersten. Some of the many shows she's been part of the producing team for on Broadway include Fool for Love, The Visit, Far From Heaven, The Elephant Man, Bridges of Madison County, Hair. Very recently, as producer of musical theater for New York City Center, she was behind the glorious production of Parade. She is an executive producer for the musical Born for This. She serves as the line producer for Beetlejuice on Broadway and the national tour. And at present, she's the interim artistic director of the renowned theater festival, the Williamstown Theater Festival. She was also involved in the off-Broadway production of Sweeney Todd. She works with an extraordinary organization called the Campfire Project, an arts program that primarily serves Syrian and Ukrainian refugees overseas. She was the executive director of Friends of the High Line and the associate producer of the Public Theater in New York City for many years. She also served as artistic director of the Naked Angels Theater Company. And at sea, she's the creative producer for Virgin Voyages. I am so thrilled and honored to welcome my friend, Jenny Gersten, to the podcast.
Honestly, I was literally like really trying to remember the first time I met you. And I cannot, because I always feel like my adult life somehow has included your talent and beauty and grace and kindness and diplomacy. And I really want to share you with my listeners because your story is remarkable. I just want to add for those of you who don't know that she's also the daughter of the legendary Bernie Gersten, who was one of the OGs at the Public Theater and then ran Lincoln Center for many, many years. And her glorious mom, Cora, who was a dancer in her youth, became the founder of the Joyce Theater, among a million other things that both her parents have done and Jenny to kind of keep arts and culture alive and accessible in New York and worldwide. So that is a very long introduction. And now I really want to turn the mic over to you so that you can share your story, both origin and currently, about why and how the arts are just imprinted in your DNA and in your children's DNA and just all that you bring to the world of the arts. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Alana. I'm so happy to be here. That introduction was crazy. Who is that person? I think you named it, right? My incredible parents. That's exactly my origin. I mean, they are, my father's no longer with us, of course, but my amazing mom and growing up with my incredible dad and my sister. I mean, just, you know, the arts were just part of our everyday lives. And my mom and dad did extraordinary things. They did all these building projects in New York City. So it wasn't just the art making, but it was the place making.
Right.
And I think having those two things in tandem was deeply impactful. And seeing how artists, administrators, everyone that they work with, board members, staff, how they respected and loved the people that they worked with and how they were in turn loved and respected. So
tell me a little bit about you know, for those of us who grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey, like I did, with the most loving, extraordinary parents in the world who brought me to the theater, but they were not making it themselves or hosting Christmas parties with the who's who of the American theater. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like growing up in a home where the most extraordinary creative talents on every aspect, right? In every aspect, the way you described the building to the art being made for the building. What are some early memories that you have of that kind of vibrant artistic household?
I'd be totally honest.
Yeah.
I had the biggest crush on Raul Julia, like when I was 5 years old. That's what I remember. Like, you gave me that prompt. I was like, I remember having a huge crush. Like, Raul Julia was always hanging around. You know, all those public theater actors were around in those early days, those 70s, from the 1970s, like the foundational days of the public, of the Shakespeare Festival, which is what they called it then. And it was like Sam Waterston and Raul Julia and, you know, John Ware and, I mean, just incredible people. But all I remember is that my first real love was Raul.
So you're using your little known fact now. That's basically what you're going to do.
That's true, actually. That is a little known fact. I have another one in my back pocket in case you need it.
But that's a really good one. My God, Raul Julia. I mean, I just watched it.
But I mean, I shouldn't be coy. I don't mean to be coy. To answer your question, I mean, it's not as fancy as those people. Being around creative people is, as you know, like very inspiring and very alluring, mostly, right? I mean, those creative people are the reason that we go into the business, because it's so intoxicating in the good way. I suppose also maybe the bad way, but mostly in the good way.
But a lot of times people who kind of grow up in a family business, whatever it is, can sort of be overwhelmed by the expectation of them by going into the family business. So was there a time where you sort of thought, oh, I'm going to go way in another direction? Or were you always interested in being a part of this industry somehow?
I knew it from a pretty early age, but when I was heading to college, my dad said, look, you know, your mom and I have really spoiled you. You know, we've raised you kind of in this exclusive environment, and we've made it look like it was fun. And, you know, I don't think he ever said glamorous, because I don't think my dad felt it, you know, like to put it in that kind of trope. But he used to say, oh, you know, we really did sort of skew you in that regard. And I want you to remember, as you go to college, will you please think about all the ologies that are out there, from archaeology to zoology. And so I went to Oberlin College in Ohio, and I got there and I thought, oh, I'll check out the theater department. And I spent about 2 days in the theater department and thought, uh-uh, I don't need to be here. And so I became an archaeology major.
Wait, did you say archaeology?
I just went with the first one on the list. It was slightly random. However, I had a real interest in art history and a real interest in anthropology and a real interest in geology. And all of those subjects made up for an archaeology major at Oberlin, which did not have an archaeology department. But if I took classes in those three disciplines, I could end up being an archaeology major.
But what an incredible kind of investigation into
history.
It's perfect. And mankind in every way. And sort of, okay, so you did that in school.
And layers, right? Like layers. Sedimentary layers.
Yes. And so I love it. I mean, Beanie Feldstein talks about how being a sociology major was like the most important thing in terms of her preparation for a career as an actor, right? The ways in which these things feed us unknowingly. When you said, just, I want to circle back, when you said, like, I ran away from the theater department immediately, was there a part of you that was thinking about being a performer? Did you do plays when you were a kid?
I did a little bit, and I was terrible. But I
can't believe you.
I truly was. My cousin Alexandra ran, back when it was like not even a real practice in the industry, my cousin ran a program called New Writers at the West Side, at the West Side Arts Theater, which was a play reading program before anyone was really doing play readings. And one of the first play readings she did was a play by a guy named John O'Keefe, and needed a kid actor in it. So I went and did that, and Andre Gregory directed me in it. And it started a lifelong friendship with Andre Gregory. He and I are still friends to this day since I was 12 years old. And he thought I was a great actor, but I'm here to tell you, Alana Levine, I was a terrible actor.
So when you got out of school, how did you begin your career in earnest?
I did some I did mostly museum work, like internships, during my college years, but during my January term. But in the summers, I would intern at the Eugene O'Neill Playwrights Conference. So I started doing that when I was 17. And I did 3 summers there. And that was pretty formative because Lloyd Richards was the artistic director. He was an extraordinary mentor to me. And then, of course, that's really where I began my artistic community, was the actors and directors and playwrights who were participating in the conference those summers. So that was very formative for me. And I met an actor who I had a crush on, actually, another crush. It really reveals a lot today. And he was leaving the Playwrights Conference, and he said, come see me in these shows at ESC, Ensemble Studio Theater. I'm going to do these plays with Willie Reale and the 52nd Street Project.
Got it.
And so a couple weeks later, I went to EST and I saw this guy in the plays, and this guy named Willie Reale came out on stage and said, I'm doing this thing with these kids in this neighborhood and these theater artists. It's a mentoring program. And he was very charismatic, but the program really blew me away. So I asked if I could be an intern there, and they essentially let me be, and they hired me. And after my first job in the industry was at this grassroots mentoring organization. And from there, I just, I gained a lot of skills there, and it was really fun to see that organization grow because it was very early days, and then grew a lot while I was in the 5 years I was there. And then from there, I got my first producing job with Mike Ritchie at Williamstown Theater Festival.
Okay. So that was sort of how your relationship with Williamstown began.
Yeah.
And when you look back at sort of your kind of coming up under the kind of mentorship of someone like Michael, and then kind of thinking about like how you are, you're at the helm now. Are there things that you learned at that time from observing him or working with him that you're like, I still carry that with me to this day? Like, I like that. I like how he did that.
That's a great question. I mean, Michael, Michael and I had so much fun together. I think he is really important to me for how he approached the work to say, make sure you're working with people you love and projects you believe in, and listen to the director more than anything else. He really did teach me that the director, because he wasn't a director, he really relied on the relationships with directors to help create the programming of a theater. And I think, but mostly what he really, really taught me was to have fun. He had said, that sounds so trivial, but it's not. We loved working together and we had so many laughs.
And then at some point, I don't know if it was right after, your timeline better than I, but you ended up at
the Public.
That's
when I came to Naked Angels. No, I came to Naked Angels after Williamstown.
And then the Public.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I guess that's probably where I got to know you best. I cannot believe you took on Us Crazies. That was the first time you were an artistic director of a theater company, the boss lady. What was that like for you?
It's so interesting. I always wanted to be my dad. My dad started the Public Theater Joe started the Public Theater, and my dad came in, and my dad was associate producer for these incredible and unbelievable years at the New York Shakespeare Festival. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be the person behind the great person, just helping create the things, making, taking the yeses from that leader and helping to materialize them. And I don't need to be out front, and I don't need to be, in the public eye. And when Michael Ritchie got a job running a theater in Los Angeles, when he was working at Williamstown, we'd worked together for 9 years at that point. He turned to me and he said, you should take my place at Williamstown. And I was like, absolutely not. That's not who I am. I'm the person behind the person. I don't want to be out front. And he said, you could do it. You'd be great. And I said, no. And he said, try it. So I went up for the job because I loved Williamstown so much at that point. And I didn't get it. And so then I left crestfallen because I had spent 6 months with the search committee and in my soul walking around in shoes as a potential artistic director. And I suddenly really wanted to do it. So when Naked Angels called, I was thrilled to take on that responsibility. And to answer your question, I found it both incredible for the opportunity to say yes to artists and really engage in those conversations in a real way, and incredibly lonely because the amount of responsibility and the idea that you can't ever turn to someone and be like, is this the right thing to do? And I'm not sure how to move forward. Or it, that sense of loneliness was profound and very strengthening ultimately. Mm-hmm. I really look back at those years of Naked Angels and I think, wow, I developed such strong muscles to begin real resilience.
Yeah. And so what was it like? Was it this insane homecoming in a way when you find yourself at the Public Theater, which is, I mean, the Mecca for so many artists who came to New York? That was the dream, like to be a part of that building, because it's so much more than a theater. It is a community clubhouse of the greatest artists of all time. And there you are. And was Oscar the artistic director when you went? So exactly. How did that happen?
I was at a luncheon for a founder, a foundation that gave money to Naked Angels. It was a small luncheon for this tiny foundation that gave us money, but also and gave scholarships. And it was their holiday luncheon, and Oscar was there because they gave money to the Public. And I didn't know Oscar Eustace. He had just gotten to the Public a couple of months before. And at the end of the luncheon, we were standing around the lobby, you know, saying our farewells. And I said, do you want to share a taxi downtown? Cold. I didn't know him. And he said, sure. And I got on the taxi with him, and I basically talked at him for 15 minutes. I didn't let him get in a word edgewise. I just talked about myself and my journey. Uh-huh. And basically what I've already shared with you.
Yeah.
And at the end, when we got to the Public Theater, because I was going down to Disperosa Street, I dropped him off at the Public and he looked for his wallet and he didn't have it on him. So I had to follow, he had to send me a check. And I kept finding him at parties and sort of like, you know, razzing him. And eventually I convinced him to make a job for me at the Public. And I was so thrilled because I got to, A, have my dad's title there, which was incredible. He let me be associate producer. And B, I got to exactly what you said, Alana. I got to be back at the Public in this life force of a building, of a cultural institution in New York City, but also the place of my childhood.
Incredible.
So it was so meaningful.
Yeah.
And also after those years of like real, really challenging work at Naked Angels, to be able to be at the Public and be of service. I mean, I didn't get to the autonomy, the joy of autonomy of being an artistic director, but I was like, but I get to be in this building and be of service to my community that I love. I was so happy. And I loved working with Oscar too.
Yeah. Well, talk.
And
about
we did, you, as you mentioned, we did some great shows in those years.
Oh,
I mean,
my
just
God.
Incredible shows.
Yeah. You know, there for the few people who may not understand what your job is, can you talk a little bit about, you know, obviously you've had a lot of different titles, but all of them are about sort of what you said, which is supporting a director and a playwright and an artistic vision for each production, which is led by someone else, production to production, and being of service to that, but also getting to make choices about what productions are going to happen in the institutions that you are, as you rose in the hierarchy of an institution, you started to get to not just support, but be in service to all of us by choosing the thing that we're going to mm-hmm. see. So how does one over time gain the confidence to trust their taste in a certain way? How did you evolve in that way from I'm being in support of others' taste to this is my taste?
I don't know that that's how I think of it. I know that there's like a neurological or something thing that happens in me when I'm talking to an artist about a potential project, or even reading or seeing something, where I think, or even seeing a performer, you know, where you're just like, wow, that person is lighting, like they're doing something that's making me see it differently. It's like waking me up. It's lighting me up. What, breaking me open. There's so many different ways that art can like affect you. So, but what is it ultimately? It's basically just a form of listening to your heart, right? Like that thing of like, trust your gut or listen to your heart, that kind of very everyday advice that we have to, it's so easy. It sounds cliche, but it's so foundational, right? So I think it's just that.
So if that's your TED talk, right? Like if your TED talk is that art is love, right? That the piece, right, speaks to your every part of your body is excited by this conversation or piece of work. Is that something that you have always had, or have you learned how to listen to yourself as you've matured?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're really young, there's so much noise.
Yeah.
Right? And I think you're trying, also you're doing a lot of gaming. And I think that's a way to explain it, right? Like, oh, if I do this, then I'll get this New York Times review. Or if I do this, I'll get this famous person. Or I'll sell out the theater. I'll sell all the tickets, right? I think you're always like, there's like a manipulation kind of strategy way. And I think you're right. I think there's something about the stillness over time. Mm-hmm. To just go like, no, hold on. What feels right? That I maybe have developed.
Okay. So, I mean, you shared really openly just moments ago that it sounds to me like not getting the artistic directorship of Williamstown the first time around was pretty painful for all sorts of reasons at the time. And obviously everything happens for a reason, quote unquote, and the journey is like so circuitous in a way, but you kept returning there. Right, in these different these different ways. So there was such a like pull to that particular theater, that institution, the history of that place, that even with kind of some wounds from the past, you were willing to throw your hat in the ring or be courted back. What has that been like to after all of these other journeys? And also you do so much at the same time. You know, people don't understand a summer theater program is a year-long job. And I don't know that everyone realizes that just because the plays are there 2 or 3 months a year, the office is open and work is happening all the time. But while you're doing that, you also are producing a lot of other things independent of the Williamstown Theater Festival. Talk to me about going back. What is that like? Going back someplace on your own terms, and how has that been feeling as of late?
Oh my goodness. Well, I mean, it is a place, my first 9 years there with Michael were so formative for me, and also were the time when I really kind of grew up. You know, I got married during that time. I had both of my children while I was working at the Williamstown Theater Festival that first time. So I had deep roots in that community. And I do think that that place is magical. And again, also informed by the wonderful time I had with everyone there when I was working with Michael. It's pretty powerful, that time for me. However, I think going back has been equally fulfilling for different reasons, to sort of try to put my own, you know, my own stamp on the place, and to make new memories for other people that are just as joyful and fruitful, I think has been very powerful for me. That sort of describes my second time. My first time as artistic director, my second time back. Now that I've been here a year as the interim artistic director, I really came in to, as a bridge really for what Williamstown has been, because Mandy Greenfield, who is my predecessor, who ran the festival the last, you know, many years, did such extraordinary work here with new work and strengthening Williamstown's sort of place in the larger American theater field to just be a home for new work and new writers. So I think she's been incredible for that. But now we've been working on sort of how we redefine what a summer theater is, because that's based in this sort of summer stock model that requires a lot of exploitation and free labor, which we of course cannot continue. So we've been looking at all of the equity issues, lowercase equity issues, and inclusion, and making sure that there weren't barriers for people to participate, and not just expanding what a summer theater looks like. So that definition or that container is the thing I've been really interested in the past year. So we're still working on that.
Right. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that the last time I saw you was at the gala opening of Parade, which was at City Center. And it really was one of these moments in the theater that everyone was buzzing about, and those lucky enough to see it felt so privileged. And there was this uncertainty if that would be its only moment in New York, or if maybe, you know, there was so much buzz about it going forward. Is that something you can talk about? I don't think it's a secret that there's a want for it to happen. Is that?
I think that's exactly right. What can I say? I think it was a thrilling, it is one of the great memories of my lifetime is Parade. I thought it was absolutely incredible to be part of it. Mm-hmm. And that Michael Arden, the director, did just a beautiful job, and that score by Jason Robert Brown is breathtaking, and Glenn Patton, Michaela Diamond were just exquisite. So I did feel, Alana, that piece is asking for more life.
Yeah.
And it's actually not even asking. It's kind of demanding it.
Yeah.
So I suspect that its call for that will be answered. But right. I don't have anything official to tell you today.
Okay. Fair enough. When I mentioned that you were a producer on Beetlejuice, that was another, like when Beetlejuice put up its closing notice, fans were outraged. The internet moves news around so much and so quickly, it's mind-blowing, right? So when you're at the center of sort of a show that is having that kind of like moment, both the joy of it, the sadness, the unbelievable sadness, and then it comes back, like it's such a crazy, amazing story. Can you take me through a little bit what it's like to be inside the heart of something like that?
I have to tell you that Beetlejuice is like, I think you and I should like get off this podcast in a few minutes and start talking about doing another podcast series that just details the incredible story of Beetlejuice.
Okay.
It is honestly a case study.
Okay.
In how, because Broadway shows, generally speaking, behave very similarly in a lot of ways that I will not bore you with, but there's like sales trends and there's like audience trends. And like, yes, of course, there's always a fan base for a specific show that like gets upset when a show is closing. But when Beetlejuice had the stop clause invoked, which is what happened, right? It wasn't that the producers chose to close Beetlejuice. The stop clause was invoked, which again, this is another chapter for another podcast.
It's a real estate question.
That's exactly right. It's in our lease. It was an unexpected thing. And again, I don't want to get too technical in the little bit of time we have, but it wasn't just that the fans were a huge part of Beetlejuice, but Beetlejuice, because it found a non-traditional Broadway audience of people who are primarily age 25 to 44 and who are primarily not women, which is extremely unusual in the space, it did become its own thing. And also a lot of young people who are both male, you know, who are non-binary male and female, like identify all kinds of different ways. But the fan base is different than any other Broadway show.
Well,
the audience, the buyers,
yes,
not the fan base.
Yes,
the fan base
is another. Yes. And anyway, so it must have been incredibly joyous to bring it back, right? To be able to deliver. And now there's a national tour that's going to happen.
Yeah. So, last night in San Francisco.
So there you have it. So what a happy ending. Definitely.
Welcome to a show about death that continues to keep having life. Yes.
Well, by the way, Broadway Podcast Network is always asking me to bring new show ideas. And if you're willing, if you're really willing to sort of do a mini series on the genesis, the evolution, the birth, the death, the rebirth of a Broadway show, I think deconstructing it would actually be fascinating. I think there's an audience for it, and it is something that I would love to deep dive with you. I know you have so much spare time.
I think it's a really good idea. It was a world premiere idea as this interview is happening, and I think it's a very good idea.
I think it'll be fun, and I can already see the guest lineup, and I think it's one special guest star each week. So that's done. And it will coincide, of course, with us also talking about Parade on Broadway. So that's going to be awesome too, when that happens. I want to know, as I read on Virgin Voyages is part of your resume, I just need to touch on that for a second, because I wish I had the trademark for it. It's two great words next to each other. Can you just tell us what that means to be the creative producer of At Sea?
Yeah. So Virgin Voyages is a new corporation and they launched their cruise ship business. Well, they tried to launch in early March 2020. Guess how that went?
Not great.
But before then, they came to me like in 2017 or 2018 as I was starting sort of the gig part of my career. And they said, hey, we're entering the cruise ship space. We only enter industries when we think that we can do something differently. And we're interested in creating experiences at sea that you can't find on land. And so we don't want to look like the other cruise ships. We want to have, and they talked about sort of the profile of the experience on the ship, from dining and I think the idea was to try to bring in a different audience than is the typical cruise ship audience. But what it meant for entertainment was to create entertainment that you couldn't find really anywhere on land, unless you went to like deepest, darkest Bushwick or Edinburgh, right? Like they said, like, can you make shows with people who are not yet famous, but will probably be famous in like 7 or 8 years?
Wow.
And can we put those shows, and can we create they asked for a creative collective of people who would inspire each other and create almost like a resident company on the ship of new work.
That's incredible.
It was such a cool proposition. And so I just was like, and they said, so just, we want you to make one show. And I was like, well, I could try to make a show for you, but what I'd rather do is be your creative producer, because if we are trying to commission new work, you are a corporation, you don't know how to commission new work. So I can kind of artistic direct the workshop process for you. And also, I'll be able to speak artist talk to you, and I'll speak corporate talk back to them, because they're not going to trust you.
Right.
It's not, you're not going to trust each other, and I can help translate.
And is that,
so I was just basically a midwife. I mean, you asked about what I do earlier, and it's that kind of, one of the things I can do is like kind of midwife, right?
Yes, yes. And is that now back on, now that sort of, it's happening?
We made 6 new shows that were supposed to launch in 2020. We put them on a year later. They're on the first ship, Scarlet Lady. We made a new one for Valiant Lady, their second ship, which is over in Europe. The third ship, Brilliant Lady, is launching very soon, I think. And that has even more new shows on it. The shows are amazing. The artists are incredible. I have had such a good time making shows for a cruise ship. It's unreal.
Okay. The idea that there's like a downtown experimental theater version for a cruise ship for people interested in really innovative new ideas like that is so, I had no idea about this. I'm so glad I asked. That's incredible. And we're going.
It's so much fun. I'm going back. I'm going in January. I cannot wait. And my friend Sam Pinkleton, who's this amazing director and choreographer who made this wonderful show with Ani Taj, we were talking about it last night, and he's like, I can't wait to go back. Like, We have such a good time.
It's so off-brand and so fantastic. Tell me about sort of, as it is now December 2022, you are the interim artistic director of Williamstown Theater Festival. Their season starts in earnest in June.
Yeah, late June, early July, we'll start in 23, yeah.
So just talk me through a little bit before I let you go. Like at this stage in the game, like does one already know what plays they're doing this summer? Are you sort of ahead of what the announcements are for those of us who read about what's happening? So what's happening now? What do you do at this time of year to prepare for the summer?
Well, we're in conversation with artists and also representatives, of course, about different projects for the summer. I had some already that I had in my mind for next summer. And I think really the conversations have been both about what the programming is also going to be, but really going back to this conversation about like what is possible, mm-hmm. because we really are trying to shift the organization. And sometimes building the plane while flying it can be complicated. So I think we're trying to balance the challenges of reframing how the organization operates while doing things like having amazing conversations with writers and directors and actors about what shows they want to do this summer. So we're in the middle of all the complicated conversations around that.
What is a little known fact that you can share?
Very briefly, when I was in college and studying in Rome, archaeology, I very nearly became the replacement for Winona Ryder in Godfather 3.
Okay. Okay. Do you want to say anything more about it or do you want to leave it there?
I was very happy that Sophia was available.
That's incredible. Well, all right then. I did not think that was going to be your little known fact.
It is a very little known fact.
I know, but as I look at you, it makes tremendous sense to me. Jenny, thank you. Thank you for being on the podcast today. What an honor to have you.
Pleasure, Alana. I'm so happy to spend time with you.
A-OK. Little known fact, if you want to donate to the podcast, just go to littleknownfactspodcast.com/donations. Thank you so much in advance for your generosity. Have a great day. Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that you know. This episode of Little Known Facts was edited by Nicholas Klar. We record in New York City. The Little Known Facts theme song was written and recorded and sung by Georgia Famusa with backup vocals by Caleb Famusa. Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.